Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum, Ryan Dixon on this Saturday. Lots to get to this week. The Flames and Senators win again as Senators moved to within 5 points of the playoffs. Flames sticking around, second place in the Pacific Division. Also, Marcus Stroman out for the season seems like years ago, but we haven't had a chance to talk about it. We will discuss the Blue Jays' chances this season now that they've lost what was probably going to be their best starter this year. And the Raptors, oh, they win a game. First time since 2010, since I think the Macarena was the most popular song last time the Raptors beat the Miami Heat. They win yesterday at the Air Canada Center. But we start with the big top circus, that is the Toronto Maple Leafs. And for a team that is fourth worst in the entire National Hockey League, the number of storylines, the number of talking points surrounding this team is kind of ridiculous. It's kind of hilarious, and it's kind of great for a show like this because it gives us something to talk about where otherwise there wouldn't be a whole hell of a lot because they're so lousy. And they had a five-minute power play yesterday in which they gave up two shorthanded goals. But who cares what's happening on the ice? Because Nazem Kadri is the story. Late for a team meeting before practice on Sunday. Healthy scratch against the Islanders on Monday. And then Tuesday, Brendan Shanahan speaks to the media, surprisingly, out of nowhere, tells everybody that Kadri has been suspended for two additional games for what? We're not entirely sure, but you can read between the lines. And Kadri's contrite, but it's a situation where, Ryan, this team could have gone quietly into the night. They could have swept this under the rug, probably decided not to. Was that the right call?
I think it's more to the point, it's a call that they can make right now because of the state of the team. I don't think anyone believes if the Leafs were 2 points out of a playoff spot that they'd be asking one of their better offensive players to take a seat for three games. You know, Nazem has been there now through a few regimes, a few different coaches. We've heard stories before, most of it related to on the ice, right? I mean, I think it's fair to say at this point, at least from the perspective of the people who've been trying to coach and manage him, you know, he hasn't been the most receptive or the quickest to adapt. And again, you know, we're talking a lot about with reference to just becoming a better overall player and all that stuff. And obviously when Dallas Eakins was here, there was an issue about his conditioning. So, I mean, the point is there's a bit of a precedent there. The Leafs are in a position where if they are ever going to come out and whack a player for something like this, exactly, this is when they can do it. Yeah. And let's face it, it doesn't hurt the Maple Leafs' overall cause. In fact, it helps it to take a good player out of the lineup for three games. So, yeah, quite honestly, I still have to believe that Brendan Shanahan wouldn't be bringing this up if he didn't feel like there was at least some kind of issue there. I don't think he wants to open up a storm, you know, just because or just to prove a point. Clearly, they think there's some reason to make it known that they are unhappy with the way he's carrying himself. So I don't have a huge problem with it. And obviously, based on what we've heard from Kadri, it seems like whatever message the Leafs were trying to get through, at least in the immediate aftermath, it got through.
And I think that's the key there is that, I mean, obviously the team perceived something with Kadri that they felt needed to be corrected and needed to be addressed. And I guess the controversy, for lack of a better word, is the fact that they did so publicly. But I think maybe we're going to find out that ended up helping, you know, to turn Kadri around, you know, kind of, you need to make things a little more extreme in extreme situations. And maybe that's the case here.
Doesn't it seem a bit, though, Dave, like a contradiction when we hear constantly the refrain, and I feel like it's happened for as long as I can remember. I've been in the city for 30 years. as long as I can remember, that there's been this perception, and it's a reality, that this team is overcovered, that the media crush is so incredible for a team that has no history of success for almost 50 years. The number of microphones, the number of TV cameras down at Maple Leafs practice, even when they are fourth worst in the National Hockey League, mm-hmm. that's the perception. And you hear it from players present and past, and you will occasionally get pushback and outbursts from Phil Kessel, from whoever, about the coverage of this team. That being said, I mean, it seems like they do it to themselves every once in a while, whether it's Salute Gate or here with about 15 games to go in the regular season. We're talking about a 2-game suspension for one of your better players this season.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think it's as big a deal as maybe the media is making it out to be. I mean, it is a fishbowl here. Like
come on,
said.
How often does a team suspend its own player for 2 games?
But it goes back to what Dixon was saying. If this team was 2 games out of a playoff spot, first of all, yeah, they probably wouldn't do it in that scenario. But also, there'd be more to talk about. You know, I think it's kind of like a perfect storm in a way where there's so little to talk about on the ice that you're forced to look for other storylines. And then here a massive one just presents itself.
Well, exactly. I mean, so are we not talking about poor, I don't know if it's PR, I've never worked in PR, but there is a different management team as far as delivering the message of this team.
See, I don't think there's anything wrong with what the Leafs did here. They're trying to, I mean, you can disagree with the way they went about it, but ultimately, again, they're identifying a problem and this is their solution to it. And we have to wait and see to find out if it worked.
But the reality is, Ryan, that most teams would sweep this under the rug. This, you wouldn't hear about this from most teams. And you know what? Most teams have a leadership of players, whether it's the captain, whether it's the veteran players, that could, whether it's take the problem child aside and just have a one-on-one conversation, or something would happen. And, you know, the most hungry for storyline media in North America from a hockey perspective wouldn't have something delivered on a silver platter. But here we are, and that hasn't happened. I guess that speaks as well to the situation that the Maple Leafs are going through.
Yeah, it goes back to the perfect storm. I mean, not only do you have a team that you could easily argue would benefit from having a good offensive player out of the lineup, you also have a team where, you know, even before things went completely pear-shaped this year, people questioned exactly how strong their leadership was, right or wrong. I mean, what's the status of that dressing room right now? How many guys are really going to say, yeah, I'm going to put myself out there, get in a teammate's face,
yeah,
and say, you need to fly straight, when really, I mean, how could you not blame any of these guys for counting down the days until they're going to the beach, right?
Is that it? I'm sure there's part of that. That is it. But do you think if Dion Phaneuf, even if he did think he was going to be here for the foreseeable future and he was the captain for another 10 years, is he that guy to pull Nazem Kadri aside?
You know what? I've never had any problem with Phaneuf from that standpoint. Like, I don't think Dion Phaneuf lacks for caring, or I don't think he's afraid to, you know, to stand up and be, you know, the voice of a team. I think the problem with Dion has been that he's miscast on the ice as the number one defenseman. But the other thing that's worth mentioning is, you know, let's give some of the Leafs the benefit of the doubt. There's probably some guys out there still killing themselves for this team. And if you're management and you see one guy above all else who in your eyes isn't towing his weight, isn't, you know, has truly checked out, you know, maybe that is the motivation you need to say, hey, we're not going to allow this when we still have guys on this team in this miserable sinking ship who are playing their guts out.
And maybe, I mean, dare I say, maybe they know Kadri better than we do, and they know that he's the kind of guy who will respond to being called out publicly. You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
They might be working on a little more intel than us
sitting here.
I
mean, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll have to see. He's back on the ice. Hockey Night in Canada in Vancouver on Saturday, which is today, tonight on CBC, 7 o'clock puck drop in Vancouver. Here's another aspect of this as well, where we're talking about a guy who was a first-round pick, and there was a lot of expectations on him when he was drafted by this team. It's kind of, I mean, for a season that's gone so wrong in so many different areas, he's kind of been a bright spot this year. His two-way game, especially if you look at the advanced numbers, he's been one of the better players on this team. And Ryan, are they discovering that, you know, when looking at the building blocks and the few pieces that they want to keep around for this team when it takes the next step in its development and turns into a young team with potential, I guess they do want him to be part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they look at Nazem and probably in a dream world, you know who the Leafs hope they're getting this.
Sure.
But even if they added a center like Dylan Strome, who could quite conceivably be available when the Leafs are picking, I think they've got Kadri circled as a guy who they might love to have as their number two center as long as things continue on the same track. You know, he is still a young guy. He's shown some signs, and he clearly has some of the offensive instincts that you're not going to teach. He really has some skill out there. So you wonder if 2 years down the road they see a situation where they're going to draft someone in 2015 who could be the lead horse, and they think Nazem will be a great number two.
And, you know, you go back to the trade deadline when we all assumed that they were – or we know that they were trying to blow it up or whatever. Kadri's name wasn't mentioned as one of the guys that they were looking to get rid of, or that everyone assumed, you know, they'd try to rid themselves of. And it kind of speaks to the fact that, yeah, I do think they value this guy in terms of their long-term plan, and that's what this plays into that as well.
The crazy thing with the Leafs is, for as awful as it's been, you can still go up and down the lineup and circle almost a handful of names and say, this is a young guy who's shown something.
Yeah.
Like, you start with the old young guy like Phil Kessel, James Van Riemsdyk.
26, 27.
Sure. He's still really not by any means an old player. And you go through James Van Riemsdyk and Nazem Kadri. You got Morgan Riley on the back end, who more and more looks like 2 years from now, I mean, he's going to be the next captain of the Leafs, right? Like, they'll go, Dion will get traded this summer. They won't have a captain for a year. Then it'll probably be Morgan Riley. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're obviously, last year things were great for Bernier, but there's still, again, if you want to play the advanced metrics game, there's a lot to show that Bernier is more likely to be part of the solution than the problem. So as much as we're conditioned here to talking about how terrible things are, it's actually crazy when you zoom out and go, there's more than one piece on this team. If they can kind of build some things around it, you know, they're clearly going to get a really good player in the draft. You don't know exactly what you're getting, but you're adding one. They've got William Nylander coming. Mm-hmm. I mean, any talk about a five-year plan, I don't think you need to worry about 5 years. I think you're looking at a team that, with a coaching change and a breath of fresh air, you can at least be looking at and going, well, there's a lot of young parts that are moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I think it was pretty shocking the way things went second half of the season.
Absolutely.
Remember, they were in a playoff spot when they fired Randy Carlyle.
So I want someone to dig this up for me, but I've been thinking that the Leafs must have a bigger discrepancy than any team maybe in sports history over a 20-game sample. 20 games is a quarter of the NHL season, basically. And their best winning percentage this year over 20 games has got to be over 600, because they won basically 10 in a row.
Yeah, they won 10 of 11.
And their worst winning percentage over 20 games has got to be like 302. Like,
yeah.
I can't imagine a situation in any sport where there isn't a catastrophic injury to a star player where you can say, for a quarter of the season, the team produced this, and then in the same season, another quarter, the team produced this.
And I mean, that's been the frustration with the team, right? Is the fact that you look at the roster, you look at the players, you see how they have had success with this group, and you think, you know, this isn't the fourth worst team in hockey.
Yeah, it's not like you're looking at the Buffalo Sabres
exactly,
at the beginning of the year going, oh my God, there's nothing there, you know?
Well, and you would say that it's fluky. Oh, well, you rattle off an incredible 20-game stretch and you have a horrible 20-game stretch. That's just fluky. You're a fluky team. But it seems like this is now the third year in a row. Well,
that's
second,
right.
If you want to go back to game seven against the Bruins. But yeah, it seems like if there's a team that can pull off incredible stretches one way or the other, it's this one.
The pattern is too troubling to ignore. If this was just a one-off, you'd say, well, we'll see what happens. But you're right. Going back, there's clearly some foundational problems. But all I'm saying, and look, I'm not here advocating for Leafs as Stanley Cup contenders by any stretch.
That's not what I'm hearing.
I'm just saying, you know, relative to teams you usually see in the equation for the first overall pick, you know, I mean, listen, you could say the same thing about the Oilers, right? There's clearly talent there and it hasn't been able to get off the ground, but so take it for what
but
it's
we,
worth.
But we haven't seen their talent work together in the way we've seen in Toronto.
Well, I would say, too, the Leafs' talent is more diverse. They've got a guy who could be a pretty good goalie. They've got a guy who looks like he's going to be a fantastic defenseman, and they've got some guys up front who can score.
Yeah, there's not much on the back end in Edmonton.
No, not for now. There's not, no.
All right, that's enough talk about the team that is fifth worst in the National Hockey League. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside Dave Zarum and Ryan Dixon. Let's look at some of the positive stories in the NHL. And how about the team that just played the Leafs yesterday and beat them 6-3? The Calgary Flames go on the road, do pretty well, pick up a point in six straight. They are still there. I mean, we were expecting them to fall on their sword at some point this season. It just has not happened. Now they find themselves second in the Pacific Division.
And I mean, again, going back to the trade deadline, when they seemed like they were sellers, you know, you kind of thought, you know, maybe they are lying down on the sword, like you said. And it's been kind of like a, you know, Bill Simmons has the Ewing theory, addition by subtraction kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of what we're seeing here. You know, you get rid of Glenn Cross and whoever else, and instead of...
Giordano goes down.
Yeah, that's the biggest one. And instead of folding, you know, they've gone in the other direction, and they seem to really have a lot of momentum behind them. I don't know how much I trust them in a seven-game series, but right now, I really like the way they're playing.
I think other than the team that ends up winning the Stanley Cup, no one can say they had a better season than Calgary, because the team has overachieved so much without taking its big plan off course. They still... As Dave said, they traded Curtis Glenn Cross at the deadline for a good return.
I tend to agree, but to take the other side of things, would you say that it could also knock perspective and expectations out of whack? Because look at what's happened in Colorado, right? They make the playoffs. They go on that incredible run last year, and they defy the metrics. They defy the odds. They buck the trend, and here they are dead last in the Central Division. Could that, I mean, it's a different scenario. I mean, Colorado has some young players as well, but you got to also realize, and it seems like the Flames do realize, that they're not a cup contender. They didn't add pieces at the deadline, so I think that's the key.
It's an interesting parallel. It's an interesting comparison with the Avs, but I think ultimately, especially when you're a young team like Calgary, getting the playoffs, getting that playoff experience for young players is really the key to it all. I mean, that's more important than anything else. Unless you're going to be in contention for the first overall pick, which even, you know, in the worst case scenario, I don't know if the Flames would have been. I think getting these guys that postseason experience is going to really benefit them down the line.
Yeah, I agree, if they can get in. And I think, again, with Calgary, sort of like we were saying, comparing the other Alberta team, Edmonton, to Toronto, if you compare Calgary to Colorado, again, the Flames are a bit more diverse in that they do have a fantastic defense pair with Brody and Giordano when Giordano's in the lineup, and obviously, unfortunately, he's not right now. So, yeah, the fact that they have been able to keep their eye on the big picture while still greatly overachieving, I agree. Expectations will probably be too high next year. It's a death march in the West to make the playoffs. It's not going to surprise anyone if the team doesn't put up as many points next year, but you still are looking at Sean Monahan, the year he's having as a second-year center. You forget, too, this team drafted Sam Bennett last year. He's been out the whole year with a shoulder injury, but, you know, they've got a guy who was a high pick who's going to be ready to presumably step in, and, you know, maybe they can find a nice secondary role for him next year because of the Jerome McGinley trade. They did have some extra picks in the last couple drafts, so
I mean,
they're set up.
Goudreau's a guy who I think...
Sure, exactly.
I don't know if you success. Expected this from him.
Oh, I mean, not at all.
He had a great pedigree in college and whatnot, but he's a fourth-round pick. He's going to be one of your go-to scorers. Sometimes I think, you know, your plans change on the fly. You know, when you see this group come together, maybe guys like Goudreau, Monahan, exceeding expectations, suddenly you expedite your kind of your plan.
Also, I don't think it can be overstated how much of a difference goaltending can make. How much, I mean, where are the Edmonton Oilers in their development if they've had a goaltender the last 3 years?
No doubt. If Devin Dubnyk played for them the way he's playing for Minnesota, at times he probably was. He just wasn't getting any help there.
Right, yeah.
If you look at his save percentages, they were actually pretty decent in Edmonton. But yeah, no question. No question that if the Oilers, you know, that's still got to be priority one, is go out there and find someone who can stop the puck and stop the bleeding a little bit.
Let's go out east and talk about the Hamburglar because he has a great nickname. And his name is Andrew Hammond. And he's an older guy as far as people making their NHL debuts. They don't normally make them in their late 20s. And they don't normally have kind of a mediocre minor league career. And then come into the National Hockey League and then put up a record of 9-0-1 in your first 10 games. They won again yesterday. They're now 5 points back of the Boston Bruins for that second wild card in the Eastern Conference. And there's still 15 games to go. And I know it seems like a large margin, and it seems like a parallel universe where the Senators are passing the Bruins here for the final playoff spot, and the Bruins are finishing on the outside looking in. But also, they're just 7 points back of the Capitals with 2 games in hand on Washington. And that's a team that hasn't played all that well. But the Senators are a team that I think we expected to be in the mix there, Connor McDavid-ish. But it's just there's so many teams tanking, I guess, Ryan, when you look at the Eastern Conference, and it's just so wide open that and maybe Dave Cameron is starting to get through to these players, or maybe it's just a fluky thing.
Ottawa's actually, if you zoom out the past few years, a fascinating team, because every time you think they're going to zig, they zag. Like, if you go back to 2011-12, they were absolutely thought to be, you know, completely written off before Paul McLean came in there. And if you remember, they overachieved. They made the playoffs. They took the Rangers, the number one seed that year, to 7 games. They almost won the series. And then 2013, in the lockout shortened year, after that season, they lost to Pittsburgh in the second round. The season they got Bobby Ryan, people were starting to circle Ottawa as like outside contender. Like, here they come. They're really on the rise. They'd lost Jason Spezza and Alfredson, but the theory was that they were really a team that had the right mix. And then they were terrible last year, gave up way too many chances, you know, just had an absolutely miserable year. Bobby Ryan didn't look any good there. And then coming into this year, as you said, Ben, you know, people are talking about them as an outside contender to draft Connor McDavid, and here we are. I mean, they're making a strong push. They have a fantastic offensive defenseman in Eric Carle. I mean, he brings something that I don't think no one joins the rush like that guy from the Blue. He's just amazing the way he can fire up there. And yeah, sure, we're going to talk about Hammond because he's been this crazy story, but Mark Stone, Mike Hoffman, guys who are in their first year who are putting up very good numbers and who have been brought along slowly, which lends some credibility to their development. Kyle Turris and Mika Zibanejad in your 1-2 hole. While that might not blow you away, but they're, you know, Turris we've seen, maybe he is better suited as a number two, but he's a good offensive player. He's still young. Zibanejad's coming along. And all of a sudden now you're back to looking at Ottawa going, you know what? They've done a nice job of finding players and they've got something going there a little bit. So you're right. It seems like, I think in this day, mathematical driven day and age where we're used to plugging in an equation going 7 points out with 15 games left, forget about it. But there seems to be a little something going on there. And the fact is the Bruins haven't been great. They've got their stuff together a little bit recently, but Washington is floundering a bit. Boston hasn't been blowing anyone out of the water. There's probably some pieces in place where if you were going to see a crazy run out of nowhere to make it, Ottawa probably fits the bill a bit.
I mean, I still think Boston's getting written off a little early. I mean, they've won 4 straight. They're 7-2-1 in their last 10. Sens are, 8-1-1. So, I mean, it's pretty similar there. I think, I don't know if I see Ottawa closing in, but it must be great for those fans to see them, like you said, kind of overriding expectations. And in the case of the Hamburglar, I mean, it's a great nickname. And it's like a Disney plot as well. Great sports movie to be made out of this. But I wonder how much of it is like, you know, I mentioned before the show, is like a starting pitcher the first time through a lineup, you know, before he gets figured out.
Well, I mean, you look at his minor league numbers and it's a head scratcher, right? This season in the AHL, played 25 games. His save percentage was under 900. It was .898 in 25 games. In 11 games this season in the NHL, his save percentage is .954.
Now, don't forget, though, they have Craig Anderson on the bench now, who was quietly among the save percentage leaders in the NHL and then was injured. Obviously, that's how Hammond ended up getting his chance when Leonard and Anderson went down. But it's not like even if Hammond gets exposed the next time he's out, like the Sens have to throw in a junior B goalie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great story, though, no question. The San Jose Sharks find themselves on the outside of the playoff picture looking in for the first time in a long time. They're at 76 points, 3 points back of the Kings for that second wild card spot, and the Kings have a game in hand on San Jose. Winnipeg on the outside looking in now as well. But the news coming out of San Jose is interesting. It seems like there's maybe no Western Conference team with more drama yearly than that Sharks team. They took the C away from Joe Thornton the offseason. They had the playoff collapse against the Kings, blowing a 3-0 lead. And Doug Wilson telling season ticket holders the other day that he took the C away from Jumbo because he just cares too much and he lashes out under pressure. And then what does he do, Ryan? Joe Thornton lashes out at general manager Doug Wilson. He has a no-trade clause. There's seemingly a ton of trade rumors surrounding him every offseason. Have the Sharks totally screwed this up? I mean, they were a regular season juggernaut for seemingly year after year after year, and they're not this year. It was just playoff collapse after playoff collapse. But did they blow it? Did they blow their opportunity? Is that it for this incarnation of the Sharks?
That's a good question. I think it's tough because, you know, when a team consistently falls short of winning the Stanley Cup, a team that you have circled as having the potential, eventually people think things have to change. Whereas to some degree, it's San Jose still has a good nucleus, and you wonder if just basically give yourself as many chances to get into the dance as possible, and hopefully one of these times your number's going to be pulled. I'm sure that's cold comfort for San Jose fans who just haven't seen this team get there. But every year we talk about how tough it is in the West. I don't know how many times this has happened in the last, you know, 5-6 years, but my guess is San Jose has probably lost to the eventual Western Conference champion or Stanley Cup champion 3 or 4 times. They lost to the Stanley Cup champion in 7 games last year. I mean, so did the Chicago Blackhawks and Anaheim Ducks. They have such a good core there with the older generation of Marleau and Thornton, and they've obviously along the way got Pavelski and Couture, who are now, they're not young guys, but, you know, they've come along since Marleau and Thornton have been the core. It's just, it's more a situation where they've, you know, with the exception of a season here or there, they haven't had great goaltending. Niemi has been good at times, but not so hot recently. I understand why a movement rises up that, you know, is demanding change and something has to, like, you feel like there has to be an explanation. Well, there must be some reason why. But the truth is they keep going up against teams that are, you know, really, really, really good, and they just haven't been able to get the best of them. So if you think your best course then is to take very good players like Joe Thornton and alienate them to the point that the best solution is to trade them, I don't know. I just feel like there's a little bit of a be careful what you wish for element in San Jose.
Yeah, I'm with you 1,000% on that one. I mean, you ask if they blew their chances by not moving these guys or not blowing up the nucleus. And when you see that kind of success like you're talking about, I mean, it's really hard to be proactive and to just kind of kill it while it's still working for you. And even now, they're still 3 points out of a playoff spot. You know, the sky isn't quite falling there yet. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to take a real proper bottoming out before they start over there.
I just think a core of Thornton, Marleau, even as those guys get older, mm-hmm. Pavelski, Couture, if you can do a little bit more on the back end and in net, I still think you've got 2 or 3 years where you could conceivably be the team that does it.
Is it possible for Wilson and Thornton to exist, though?
I don't know. I'm sure Joe Thornton, who is known as a pretty accommodating guy, you know, he's kind of big, easygoing Joe, or at least that's what we thought until Doug Wilson said he lashes out at everyone. I think he probably feels like he's had enough because this has been almost now a year of just ended up being the fall guy
He told his GM to shut up.
Yeah, and you know what? He probably, back of his mind, is thinking, I might outlast this guy now if we miss the playoffs. And if there's a new regime in this summer, I'd love nothing more than to play out my last 3-4 great years in this place that I love living, that still has a good team. And you know, if we get some new direction in here and there's a breath of fresh air, maybe there's still a chance for a fairy tale ending in San Jose.
Plenty more to come. The Blue Jays lose what was supposed to be their best starter this season and was headed in that direction, especially the way last season, the second half, played out. Marcus Stroman done for the year. Also, the Raptors beat the Heat and NFL free agency going absolutely berserk. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Ryan Dixon on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Gare Joyce.
You think Major League ball players lead charmed lives? For the most part, yeah, it's pretty sweet, even for guys playing for the league minimum. But a lot of guys leading charmed lives now have been kicked around before. Take two guys playing first base for the Jays this spring. I was down in Dunedin talking to them a few days ago. Edwin Encarnacion is an all-star, making $9 million a year. His back is sore just from lugging his wallet around. Sweet life, right? Well, it wasn't so long ago, a few years, that the Jays outrighted Edwin to Vegas. Looked like he was ticketed out of the majors, maybe headed to Japan. But Edwin clawed his way back, got serious about the game. The Jays picked him off waivers, gave him a whole second life. And a second life is what Justin Smoke is looking for in Toronto. A former first rounder, an All-American, prototypical long ball hitter. He was even the big piece in a trade for Cliff Lee not so long ago. And it never really happened for him in Texas and Seattle. Yo-yoing between the majors and AAA. 19, 20 homers, but Mendoza line average, a part-timer at best. At 28, what should be his prime, Smoke was claimed by the Jays off waivers. He has a one-year deal and probably not a whole year to prove his worth. Edwin Encarnacion told me that he's going to talk to Smoke, going to tell him how he turned around his own career when it looked like he was done.
This game is hard, but you have to keep your head up and keep focused in this game. And now, like, I'm going to talk to him when I have the time. Like, he's going to get the opportunity here to try to change his career. And sometimes you need change.
If you think it's always a charmed life, check out the ups and way downs of Edwin and Smokey.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand. This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live. I am Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Ryan Dixon on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Blue Jays spring training rolling right along. And man, I posed this to Mike Wilner last week about maybe spring training being a bit too long because it's just the risk of injury seemingly goes up, especially when you're talking about more than a month of fake games. Jose Bautista took a pitch off the hand wrist area. It looked really, really scary, but he was able to shake it off. He was okay yesterday. But the Blue Jays have already suffered two pretty bad injuries. I was going to say two catastrophic injuries, but one of them, while it looked catastrophic at first, isn't going to be nearly as catastrophic as we thought because Michael Saunders had the majority of that meniscus removed from his knee, and instead of returning at the All-Star break, he took BP the other day. He might be ready for the start of the season. But the catastrophic injury occurs when Marcus Stroman, in a bunt drill, pitcher's fielding practice, he was called off by Josh Donaldson, planted his foot, and his knee just went berserk. He quote-unquote heard a pop. Everybody hears a pop. Whenever you hear that, that's bad. And tore up his knee real good. He will miss the entire season. So now the Blue Jays seemingly have a couple of their young pitchers that will be in the rotation. And the question that was posed and maybe the most intriguing headed into this spring training was, will Aaron Sanchez be a reliever or a starter? It seems like that has now been answered with this. He will be in the starting rotation, and it seems like Daniel Norris, I guess, will be in this rotation as well. But, Dave, when you're talking about losing a guy like Marcus Stroman and the hype at which he entered the major leagues last year, what does that do to this team's chances and maybe the overall feeling of this team headed into the regular season?
Well, you know, I think it might impact the latter more than the former, like the feeling of the team more than their actual win-loss record. You are worse off, obviously, when you lose a guy who might be your best pitcher. You know, if in a perfect scenario, he could have been maybe your best, at least statistically, your best guy this year. But I think where it hurts you most is kind of spiritually. You know, the fan base must be crushed by this just because of the fact that so much was expected of him. He was a fan favorite, you know, a guy who a lot of people kind of could rally around. And so to see that come out of your lineup, come out of your roster so early in the season, like you said, they're like three games into spring training, and this guy's gone already. I mean, that's the crushing part. It's just kind of the mental aspect of it, I think.
But if there's something that the fans can latch onto once they set that aside, the Jays still have potentially, and as you said, Ben, it looks like this is going to be the case, two good young pitching prospects in the rotation. How many years can you say, hey, the five-man rotation is going to feature two guys who, yeah, they're going to have their growing pains. Yeah, they're going to get knocked around a bit, but there's real intrigue about what kind of pitchers they can be. So you get to watch Sanchez and Norris, and you get to see, you know, hints of what they can become and maybe some flashes of brilliance. So you really would have been getting spoiled with if Stroman, well, I guess Sanchez would have not been in there in that case. But, you know, there's still something to say, hey, you know, we're curious where this team is going to go. It's had a long, bleak past with not making the playoffs. So you're looking for any evidence possible that there might be brighter days ahead, and you've got these two hurlers who could really be something.
Yeah, you're really seeing the kind of accumulation of pitching prospects recently pay off right now because, like you said, you have the luxury, you have options right now. Whereas in the years past, Stroman goes down, that's it for your rotation that season. And now with Norris and Sanchez, you do have the shot of replacing it. Sanchez, yesterday, I think it was, looked pretty good. I mean, he looked like, I don't know, it's hard to put that much weight into a single spring training game. But, I mean, we know he's a good pitcher. Norris has been killing it in the minor leagues. So you have these options to go to, and that's got to be a huge silver lining.
And Daniel Norris lives in a van in the offseason. I don't know if you've heard that story about 6,000 or 7,000 times.
No word yet on its proximity to the river, but
yes, it's pretty close to some body of water because he surfs, as you would expect a guy from Nashville, Tennessee to do. So Stroman's gone. You mentioned he's a fan favorite and he's a guy that people root for. It seems like he's really taken up that mantle ever since arriving in the major leagues. On a full-time basis last season. He calls it the six. He was wearing the Raptors hat yesterday. You know, most times you see guys suffer injuries and then you never see him, never hear from him again until they return to the major leagues. I wonder, Ryan, when we're talking about Stroman and this little guy and how much he seems to enjoy the other guys on this team and how much they seem to enjoy him, I wonder if we're going to see him around Toronto still this season, walking around and trying to get around with that knee.
Hobbling around, you mean? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't be surprised because you're right. He really has embraced the city. And let's face it, I think one of the reasons people really latch onto that is because you think it speaks to a bit of a frontman mentality. You think it speaks to a guy who has the mindset of, I want to be in the middle of things. I put myself out there. I want to be a number one pitcher. And clearly, the biggest factor in that is having the stuff to do that, but you also have to see a guy who isn't afraid to put himself out there and it seems like he's got a little moxie. So I think you still got to take the long view on this guy, and chances are he's going to be around for the Blue Jays for a long, long time. His personality is going to not only endear him to the fans, but maybe make him a good candidate to be someone who can really be a true leader and be a give-me-the-ball guy who has the stuff to back it up.
And I mean, when I heard about the injury, I didn't know at first exactly what it was. I just knew he was out. you know, when you find out it's the knee, I mean, thank God it's not something like an elbow or something that's going to have this kind of long-term damage. This is something that
they're hoping he's going to steal bases.
Exactly.
For them,
yeah.
Right.
Like, I don't know. What he was
Although
doing,
he was a pinch runner a couple of times last year.
That's true. Yeah. And was he doing bunt practices? I mean, I don't know how much he's going to be in that scenario. But the point is, like, it's a recoverable injury for a starting pitcher, I think. So I think that that you can find some solace in that as well.
Also, there was the rumor and a lot of innuendo. First of all, it kind of happened very quickly on Twitter where Alex Anthopoulos said, hey, I'm speaking in 10 minutes, major announcement. People were speculating. They had those 10 minutes to think about the worst-case scenario. This was up there among the worst-case scenarios. Yeah. But considering that Edwin Encarnacion had felt twinges in his back and people were suspecting that maybe it was he that was going to be lost for the entire season. Considering that possibility, I mean, Stroman's good, but he's not Edwin Encarnacion.
I mean, exactly. Like, Ben, would you rather lose a starting pitcher like this or would you rather lose an everyday player?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's going to start maybe 30 games compared to a guy who's going to hit you think, 35 to 40 home runs and play 140 and 150 games. I think the drop-off is clearly bigger from Edwin to whoever his replacement is, whether it's Justin Smoker or Derek Barton, compared to Marcus Stroman or Daniel Norris or Aaron Sanchez.
But I do wonder, and obviously I'm not alone, this is a pretty obvious statement, but this is going to impact the bullpen.
Yes.
And that was already the glaring weakness on this team. Actually, I think the bottom three or four of the lineup was the biggest issue on this team. But the bullpen was obviously something that was going to give the team problems. And so to take a guy like Sanchez out of that is really going to have kind of a after effects that I think we all agree will hurt the team.
Yeah, they're going to have to expect or hope that somebody that maybe was unheralded going into this year, like a Wilton Lopez, is going to solidify that bullpen. But you don't see too many bullpens with a ton of sure things, mm-hmm. and even the sure things sometimes turn out to be not so sure things because bullpens are kind of crazy like that. When we come back, the Raptors beat the Heat for the first time since 2010, snapping off a streak of 16 straight losses against Miami. They're not a very good team right now without Chris Bosh, but the Raptors were not a very good team for the previous 10 games, losing 9 out of those 10. They're back on the winning track. And it doesn't get any easier tomorrow. They got the Portland Trailblazers coming to town. We'll break them down and look towards the future for this team. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Annis alongside Ryan Dixon and Dave Zarum. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Annis alongside Dave Zarum and Ryan Dixon. The Raptors finally snapping off that streak of 16 straight losses to the Miami Heat as they win 102-92 yesterday at the Air Canada Center. The Heat are just not a very good basketball team right now, especially without Chris Bosh, as they fall to 29-36. Raptors now the opposite, 39-26. So it was a pretty rough stretch of games for the Raptors headed into that one. Losers of 9 of their last 10. The ball wasn't moving, not a whole lot of assists, out-rebounded constantly. There were a lot of things to like about yesterday's game. Dave, are they fixed?
Oh, yeah. It was rough waters, but now, you know, the sea is clear and calm. No, I don't know. I really liked what I saw from them yesterday because I think the whole time what you needed was for your key guys, Lowry and DeRozan, to be the ones who kind of are the catalyst for turning this thing around. And yesterday, I think those are the guys who led them to the win. Really, though, as far as, you know, is it fixed? We're going to have to see Sunday against Portland and the couple games after that to see if they can sustain this. But certainly last night was what you wanted to see from this team.
Is this team where I think everybody – pretty much the whole season now, is we're up over 60 games, the conversation has been, who are the true Raptors? Are they that team that started 13-2? Are they that team that had some issues there against teams above 500? Or are they a middle-of-the-road Eastern Conference team? Ryan, when you look at the way things have gone now through a pretty good swath of the season with just 20 games left, what is this team? What are we looking at here?
I don't know, but I will say that I'm a believer a bit in the going through adversity,
yeah,
and not just that, the timing of it. So I have to say that to some degree, I do think things have gone well for Toronto in that, yeah, they were flying high in the beginning of the season. And even when DeRozan went down, they kind of didn't skip a beat. But there was also these indications that things weren't quite that rosy. Mm-hmm. I think it's good that they've been smacked around. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that you automatically develop the talent or the game plan to prevent it from happening again. But it does at least, you know, it helps the coach deliver the message. Guys, do not look at the standings. Listen to what I'm saying. And totally, believe me when I tell you, we have to be better. So I think the fact that Toronto now has a little more than a month, I guess, month and a half to really, really bear down going into the playoffs, I do think that's a good thing. So, you know, for their sake, you hope there's no more injuries. But I definitely, whatever the sport, but especially in a long, slow one like basketball where there's 82 games, I think getting popped in the mouth a few times isn't the worst thing in the world.
And also part of it is that this group, most of these guys haven't played on a winning team like that before on a top four team. So I think it's part of learning how to deal with that. They've always been the guys coming from behind.
And maybe they thought they were really good, you know, because they hadn't, you know, they didn't have the experience to say, well, we're getting away with some stuff here.
Does it say something about the makeup of this team as well, Dave, when we're talking about, there's been times over this last 11-game stretch, well, let's take it back to the 10 games before yesterday, where they've had some pretty serious first-half deficits and cut into those and made games out of them in San Antonio against the Cavaliers. Now, they've been blown out a couple of times against Golden State and in Houston as well. Remember, this all started post-All-Star game with a huge win in Atlanta over the Hawks, where they led by 30 points at one point. But there are teams, Dave, where they go down early and you can break their spirit. It seems like it's difficult to break this team's spirit.
And that was kind of a silver lining in a way during that 1-10 stretch that preceded yesterday's game, is the fact that, like, it wasn't for a lack of caring or for a lack of trying or lack of hustle and all that kind of things. The Denver Nuggets are an example of a team that really just doesn't care. You know,
1, 2, 3, 6 months to go.
Six more weeks to go. So, I mean, that's not the case with this team. These guys, they want to win, obviously. I mean, so, yeah, the fact that they are losing, you still see that fight in them, even in losing efforts, and that's got to be a good thing. And I think that starts from your leadership on the way down.
Speaking of leadership, Kyle Lowry touches the ball on every possession, usually, unless he's playing with Grievous Vasquez, because Vasquez does the ball handling, brings the ball up court when they're both on the floor at the same time. He was outstanding yesterday. 19 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists, 7 steals.
That assist mark is the key there.
Yes. Well, that's what I want to talk about, because we talk about, it's not for a lack of effort that they've been losing and the offense has struggled recently. It's been about ball distribution and making that extra pass. I don't know. Is there a reason for that, or is it just the ebbs and flows of a season, or is there something that can flip for this team to realize that, you know what, when DeMar DeRozan, when the ball ends up in your hands, everybody thinks it's going up at some point, whether it's immediately or after you pound the ball for 10, 15 seconds.
Well, I mean, as far as the flip goes, I think going 1-for-9 helps force that to happen for you to reconsider what you're doing. But yeah, I mean, you look at Lowry's numbers during that 1-10 stretch, and he was averaging 4 assists per game. And before that, he was averaging 7.5. So it's obviously a huge drought there. And like you said, ball's in his hands all the time. He's the point guard. It's going to be on him to make sure you get back to that ball distribution, to make sure he's facilitating the offense a bit more. And that's what I really loved about last night, was the fact that you did see him take it upon himself to move the ball, to be the initiator of all that, to get the team back in the groove the way that we saw them playing before. And that's why I love the 8 assists. It's just an indication that he's back to not only being a leader in terms of scoring, but also just kind of controlling everything. And I think one of the reasons that we saw kind of the ball stopping happening was, you know, when you're in a slump like that and you're your team's best player and you're a go-to guy, let's say like for DeRozan and Lowry, there's a tendency to kind of get into that hero ball mode to think, you know, I'm going to be the one to get us out of this slump, so I'm just going to take this big three here. And if I hit it, you know, I'll be the hero and we're going to turn this around. And if I miss, and you know, you're not thinking about what happens if you miss it. So I think you kind of get away from your role as a point guard when you're just thinking about, I'm going to put this team on my back and get us out of this slump. So I think it was kind of like a double-edged sword from that perspective during that slump. And again, last night, I think we saw the beginning of kind of breaking that ugly mold.
Well, and it comes on the heels of a pretty vocal performance by Kyle Lowry in San Antonio against the Spurs. He was getting on his teammates a little bit during timeouts on the court. He was giving them an earful and then walking away, which can be good. I mean, when you talk about this happening and leaders on teams, Ryan, I mean, you can do it, but you have to back it up with a performance. So in that sense, is it good that Kyle Lowry had a very strong performance in a win yesterday? If Kyle Lowry's given everybody an earful in San Antonio and then goes 1-for-10 with one assist, it's tougher the next time to take him a little seriously.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, he has a lot of credibility, though, with this team. I mean, no one disputes that Kyle Lowry is the heartbeat of the Raptors.
Amir Johnson, a couple days ago, said, you know, like, that's what we need from Lowry. We need him to be the one calling us out. You know, they ask him to call him out almost.
Yeah.
But is that not what got him in trouble in Houston with the Rockets? I mean, he had this rep coming into Toronto.
It's different now because he's established himself as an elite player and as an elite leader. In Houston, he was still an up-and-coming player, and I think people were questioning whether or not he had the merits or the resume to be
exactly what I'm talking about, right? I mean, I guess he's done enough. I mean, he was an all-star this year. He's done it for a season and a half.
See, I think then people were questioning whether or not Kyle Lowry was the guy who was supposed to be doing that. And now I don't think there's any debate that he's the guy who you need to be stepping up in that scenario.
Again, though, we're only talking about a season and a half, really, of outstanding play.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think you've seen a guy who's gone into the next chapter of his career. I don't think we're going to see the Kyle Lowry we saw in Houston anytime soon. I think he was really kind of trying to find his foot, going through different coaches, battling for a starting position. Now I think he's pretty firmly entrenched in that spot, regardless of what team he's on. But, okay, can I test out a theory on you guys?
This is a laboratory.
If we say no, you're going to do it anyways.
I am definitely going to do it anyways. But it evolves around the idea of like Lowry and your leaders. So did you guys see that Saturday Night Live? And I've tried to articulate this a few times, probably failed miserably, so bear with me. But did you guys see that Saturday Night Live reunion, the SNL 40?
Of course, everybody did.
So it was great. And
I don't know if I stayed with it for the full 3.5 hours, but
PVR.
Fair enough, an hour and a half maybe. But so basically they had like all the biggest names in comedy, all the big, huge stars who came out for that show, Bill Murray, whatever, the list goes on. But some of the skits, you know, the writing maybe wasn't that great. Some of these guys were a little out of practice as far as sketch comedy goes. But the star power is there. So you had a scenario where you can put a guy like Bill Murray on the stage and you can overcome the bad writing because he knows what to do in that scenario, right? You know, you can turn to him and the result will be comedy. You'll get laughs out of it. So I think when you translate that to the basketball court, you need to be like, if your stars are there, you need to be able to rely on them. And during that Raptors slump, they couldn't turn to a guy like Lowry and DeRozan and help them overcome the bad writing. And in basketball, maybe bad writing is Patrick Patterson having a cold shooting night or Lou Williams having a cold night or Vasquez not moving the ball around, whatever it is. What we saw against the Heat last night was the stars kind of doing their job, being those guys you can turn to and rely upon regardless.
So what we do know is there is no more star-driven league than the NBA.
Exactly.
And if your boys, if your big boys aren't your big boys, then you are in trouble. So absolutely.
Unless you're the Atlanta Hawks.
Sure, I suppose.
But even then, they have 4 all-stars. I mean, they're not lacking for star power.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that when push comes to shove, it's going to have to be DeRozan and Lowry who carry this team in the tough spot. So,
and that's what we saw last night.
But isn't it a delicate balance? Because I agree that the offense, it does run through the guards. But you can have days where you're not shooting well, And it would be nice to be able to get that easier inside bucket. Now, no Jonas Valanciunas yesterday. Jonas Jr.
Jonas Jr.
Was born, an original name. So Tyler Hansbrough got the start in his stead. I mean, wouldn't it be a little easier to diversify the offense? Because the constant refrain you'll hear, and we heard it a lot over the nine losses out of 10-game stretch, is that we're a jump-shooting team. We're a jump-shooting team. We got to get open looks. We got to hit those jump shots. It's a make-or-miss league. Wouldn't you benefit greatly by running more of your offense through the two big men in Amir Johnson and Jonas Valanciunas? And Amir and Jonas are among the top five in field goal percentage in the NBA this year.
Yeah, but part of that is because they're not relied on to kind of be the initiator on every offensive set.
Small sample size.
Yeah, but they shoot so well because by the time they get the ball, they're usually in a position where it's just an open dunk or you know, the offense has run through itself and now they have an easy look as a result. But I do think when you look at the personnel in this team, you know, it is going to be a jump shooting oriented team. It's going to be a perimeter driven team just because of the personnel there. You know, Valanciunas is a guy who you do want to see him get more touches, but at what point do you go away from what works for you? I think the ball is going to be in the hands of your perimeter players often, and with these guys particularly, they're going to shoot it. They're more shooters than they are distributors. So I don't know how much you want to change like the fundamental makeup of your team 3 quarters through a season where you're a top four team in the conference.
Getting back to what you were saying, Ryan, about the season being long and ebbs and flows and not being the worst thing in the world to lose a bunch of games in the middle of a long season and a long season in which you know you're going to finish top four because you're winning the Atlantic Division. Is the season just too long? I mean, you look in the Western Conference, I guess every game matters because it's so tightly bunched at the bottom of the conference. And you know what? There is still a fight in the East. It's between teams that are below 500, half game separating Charlotte and Miami now, and Charlotte in the 8th seed at 29-35. But there's been talk of extending the season into July so that you don't have as many back-to-backs. But there hasn't been a whole lot of talk about lopping some games off the 82-game regular season.
We all know the deal on this is that for the sport it would be great, but for the owners, it's not because it reduces gates. It's
like,
never going to happen.
Look at the NFL. They're talking about adding another
extending,
game.
Extending, yeah. But hockey and basketball could both stand to go to 65-game seasons. It'd be amazing for the athletes and probably better for the fans. It would add more meaning to games, but there's no way games are coming off the schedule.
And also, you've been seeing a lot of those big Western teams, you know, bench all their starters for the entire game.
That's
going to
be interesting because that does.
You wonder a couple nights ago.
You wonder if that's
going to
create a pressure point a little bit with the new, if we're still calling him new commissioner. But yeah, that's tricky, right? Because
you are doing a disservice to the fans.
Absolutely.
Money, like, no question.
No doubt. And you know, teams are unabashedly doing it now. It's not just Greg Popovich who's doing it here and there. You know, the Warriors rested half their lineup the other day.
And Memphis did it on a nationally televised game, which
against Washington.
I don't know how much you read into it, but it could be perceived as a major message to the league, you know?
Yeah, Greg Popovich hasn't shied away from doing that either. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Ryan Dixon. We also saw last season, and I imagine we will see down the stretch, teams jockeying for playoff position. And I don't just mean that in the general cliche sense of winning games to get into a good playoff position. But last year we saw the Brooklyn Nets almost intentionally lose games to set up that matchup with the Raptors. Ended up working in their favor. It wasn't easy, went 7 games. But I think it was Bill Simmons that came up with the theory of if you finish first, it's like a playoff draft. You finish first, you get your pick of who you want in the first round. Finish second, you get your pick of the rest up until the fourth team being stuck with whoever's left. What do we think of that idea? It would take away that end of season jockeying, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, it would be amazing from our perspective, but I think any advantage you think you would gain by, like, we match up well against this team, you would lose by that team being like, oh, you want to play us, eh? Okay, sure. So I think another logistical, while we're playing the fantasy game, another thing that logistics prevent, but I've always kind of thought would be neat, is if you are the higher seed, you get to determine when you play. You get to determine the schedule, i.e. it's not just a set format. Okay, two games at home, two games on the road. You could say, there's rules you have to work within, but you could say, we want to start on the road. We want to play two on the road, and then we want to play two at home, and whatever. You get to set the format there. But again, obviously scheduling is going to prevent you from being able to do that. But I think there should be more of an advantage, especially now, like if you look at the NHL and to some degree, I would say same thing in basketball. Yeah. When there's less to choose between the seeds, it'd be interesting to give it more weight for the high end.
I think all we're looking for is to add more importance to the regular season. That's what makes the NFL so great, right? There's only 16 regular season games. And although, there's 162 games in the baseball regular season, so few teams make the playoffs that every regular season game is important. How do we add importance to these regular season games?
I mean, I don't know. Like my first instinct was like, yeah, you cut the season down to 65 games or something. That'll help. But at the same time, you know, there's so much at risk in terms of like historical significance.
Yeah, but the NBA is not like baseball where the numbers, the single season numbers.
But if Will Chamberlain averaged 50 rebounds over the course of an 82 season. That's a horrible example. if someone averaged 30 points per game, you know, over 82 games, it's somewhat less impressive if they average 30 points per game over 65 games, right? So it just kind of distorts how we look at how we can compare players past and present, which is always fun.
I would just say that basketball is not like baseball or even football, but football is not like it either, where, you know, everybody knows that the records, the single season records, offhand, as far as totals or averages. I mean, averaging a triple-double, I guess you could get into that kind of stuff. But, yeah, it would definitely mess with that, and it would mess with, you know, 72 wins in a season.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that's really, I think, the only reason why they wouldn't do it. Well, that and the money.
Oh, yeah, there's the money.
I take it back. Mostly the money.
Mostly the money. All right, so mentioned jockeying for playoff positioning. Raptors right now pulling into a tie again with the Bulls for third in the East, and Raptors have played fewer games, so they are actually in the third spot right now, which would, if the season ended today, which at last check it will not, they would play the Bucks in the first round. What is the ideal matchup for this team in the first round? Because again, it's this whole season, it doesn't matter what they do in the regular season now that they've pretty much clinched a playoff spot and they're two games away from clinching at least a .500 record this season. Doesn't matter. Not going to matter. It's winning a playoff series. That's the benchmark for this team. If they don't do it, it'll be a failure. If they do it, it's a success. Anything after that is gravy. What is the best case scenario for this team headed into the playoffs? Is it Milwaukee? I don't know. Do you want to play in Indiana right now, the way they've won seven in a row, and the Raptors will get them coming up in a bit? Do you want Washington, the way you've handled them this season? I certainly don't think you want Charlotte.
No, that's, I don't know what it is with Charlotte. That's just a terrible, like, when's the last time the Raptors beat Charlotte in Charlotte? It's been,
I think it's 9 or 10 straight games they've lost in Charlotte.
There's something funky going on there. I think, you know, I think even though right now their record is better, I think I'd rather see the Raptors play Washington in the first round as opposed to Milwaukee. Milwaukee's a tough matchup. I think the Raptors would be the favorites in both those scenarios, but Milwaukee's a tough matchup. They're a funky team. You know, they got all the length and they're really aggressive defensively. Washington has more talent, and definitely at the top level, like John Wall specifically. But the Raptors have shown all season, they've really had their number. They really seem to be comfortable with that matchup. And I think that's the one where, just based on history, I'd be more comfortable with that.
Do you expect Dwayne Casey to be jockeying? I mean, if he's in the third spot and he sees Washington fall to sixth and they're locked into the sixth,
you know,
will they win or lose games on purpose to try and get there?
I think given the last few weeks we've seen with this team, with them playing so poorly and just really having to kind of, right now I think the emphasis is on getting back to finding their groove, you know, getting their Stella on, however you want to put it. but I think right now they just need to focus on playing well, kind of stringing together a lot of consistent, good basketball games. And you can worry about positioning after that. Right now they need to worry about getting back to where they were earlier in the season.
Earlier this week, Masai Ujiri was speaking at an event prior to the CIS Final Eight at the Mattamy Athletic Center, which continues. And you can watch it on Sportsnet 360 today and the final going tomorrow. We're talking about bringing a Canadian to the Raptors. I mean, we've seen Jamal McGlure play, I mean, at the tail end of his career, and, you know, he was never a superstar player. There are superstar Canadians, or at least one, in the league right now. It used to be two when Steve Nash was still playing, and they went after Steve Nash, and, I mean, it all turned out for the better for missing out on him.
We got Landry Fields.
Brian Colangelo ended up, signing Landry Fields. That was big. He talked about the fact that, yeah, they scout Canadians pretty hard. They're pretty intent on bringing a Canadian to this team. He said, not at the expense of anybody else, but mm-hmm. I don't know, saying that you're going pretty hard and being pretty definitive and saying we will have a Canadian on this team and not mentioning Andrew Wiggins by name, Ryan, but talking about the influx of Canadian talent in the NBA and elite basketball and the better programs in the NCAA. Is it important for this team to have a Canadian on it at one point, the way the Canadians are just filtering into the NBA?
I think it's ideal, but obviously not critical. You know, ultimately people are going to embrace the Raptors if they win. I think it's the cherry on top if you've got a Canadian kid in the center of it. It's an inevitability, right? Because as you said, there's more and more Canadian kids coming in. At some point, the Raptors are going to nab one of them. But I don't think they should be going, you know, far out of their way or compromising other things to get their hands on a Canadian player. It's not like this is a floundering market. I mean, the Raps are on the rise, clearly, in the last little while. There's lots of support. So no, I don't think they have to bend over backwards to get one.
And the Wiggins thing is puzzling. I mean, they're not going to be getting Andrew Wiggins. Like, they don't have the assets unless you're going to trade everybody. I mean, like,
unless you, well, 2021, he could be a free agent.
Yeah. Okay. So talk to me in 3 years. We can talk about what might happen 3 years from that. but you know, part of the Canadian thing with Ujiri, and I'm with you, Dixon, like, you go for the best players and that's kind of first and foremost. But the thing with Ujiri is I think he just, as a speaker, he really knows his audiences. You know, you look back to that F Brooklyn comment. Here he's speaking at a CIS conference, you know, celebrating Canadian basketball. He knows his audience. He knows that's what they're going to want to hear. I don't doubt that he wants to bring a Canadian on because there's going to be obvious, you know, positive impacts from that. But I wouldn't do it, you know, in sacrificing bringing on a better player in favor of a Canadian.
Absolutely.
Player.
What will be interesting, though, is whether those Canadians and whether Andrew Wiggins level Canadians will want to come here, because we see kind of a pushback in the National Hockey League with Torontonians. Although you hear Steven Stamkos say, maybe part of that is a negotiating ploy and Connor McDavid wants to come to Toronto.
See, I think it's different in this case because in hockey you have such a long history of Canadian teams being good. I mean, here this is like a fresh new thing that these Canadian players can latch on to. And even when they were growing up, there wasn't necessarily a huge kind of desire to be a Toronto Raptor. But now because of the winning culture here, because of the popularity around the team, I mean, I do think there's a ton of validity in Canadian players wanting to come home and play in Canada.
Would a guy like Andrew Wiggins, though, give up money? And who knows what the CBA landscape will be in 2021.
No.
But, I mean, you do see, I mean, LeBron went back home to Cleveland. He felt a pull to Cleveland. Now, he did get paid, but we know in the NBA, at least the way the CBA is structured now, the team that retains you, re-signing a free agent, that's where the most money lies. I wonder if there will be a Canadian that gives up money, and whether that's Andrew Wiggins to come to Toronto. It's tough because I wouldn't give up money, but although, I don't know, how many yachts do you need? Do you need to race those yachts?
You can never have too many yachts. Let me tell you, boys, let me tell you from experience, you can never have too many yachts. But, you know, I think with the Canadian players, it's more, I see the more realistic kind of end game here being acquiring a Canadian guy through the draft, just because there's so many great young Canadian players in college right now, in high school right now, that I think that's where we're going to see that Canadian player come in. We almost saw it last year with Tyler Ennis. You know, they were close to acquiring him at the draft. So I think that's what Ujiri's, maybe that's not what he's hinting at, but more realistically, I think that's where he's going to go with this.
And there are some highly touted younger Canadians playing the NCAA as well right now. When we come back, NFL free agency has been totally insane. And more trades than I can ever remember happening in the NFL. Buffalo Bills are going to be interesting. They won 9 games last year. I feel like people forget that. That defense already pretty good. Have they done enough to that offense to turn them into a contender despite the fact that they play in the same division as the reigning Super Bowl champs? We'll talk about that and more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Dave Zarum. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Christina Rutherford.
It was the dead of winter in Winnipeg, and Sportsnet magazine traveled to Manitoba for a profile story on the Jets' controversial star, Evander Kane. Then, everything happened. Kane got injured, his tracksuit reportedly got tossed in the shower, he announced he'd be having season-ending shoulder surgery, and he got traded to Buffalo. The question in Buffalo is, how much of a problem is Evander Kane? He's been called a jerk, a distraction, immature, selfish, cocky. So we set out to get to know Evander Kane, and some of the stuff we found might shock you. Did you know Kane didn't have a lot of money growing up? Did you know he shared a bedroom with his two sisters? Kane bought his parents a house in Vancouver after his first year in the NHL, but he won't own up to it. The league's biggest money flaunter says it's not something he feels he needs to talk about. Wait, what? Friends and teammates say what most hockey fans know about Kane is a persona. And if you sit down and talk to him, if you get beyond the flashy pictures and the shiny suits and the expensive sunglasses, you might even like the guy.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Ryan Dixon. NFL free agency going berserk. And the Buffalo Bills are one of the players of free agency as well, which is kind of weird to say. They've been one of the more interesting teams this offseason. First signing Rex Ryan as a deal to become their next head coach, and then picking up Matt Cassel, flipping Kiko Alonso for LeSean McCoy. And now, according to reports, Percy Harvin on his way to the Buffalo Bills. Ryan, we're talking about a team that finished 9-7 is a season ago, had already, by most accounts, including Rex Ryan's, of course, he's going to big up his team, but a championship caliber defense, and they won 9 games. I mean, where should we be looking at this team? There's still a long offseason to go, but where should we put them in our minds headed into next season?
Well, I guess a lot of that depends on what you think they're going to get out of the quarterback. You know, it's great that they've got these other weapons, but ultimately that's the league. You know, it's a quarterback's league. So is Cassel going to be, you know, I don't think they're expecting the sun, moon, and stars from him, nor should they be, but you know, you got to figure McCoy is going to have, you know, DeMarco Murray had a gajillion touches last year. McCoy might even bury that. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, with the good defense they had, if presumably they're going to put up some points, all of a sudden you're looking at a team that maybe could get into the playoffs and make some noise. And you wonder if this year, and this is a larger conversation for us maybe, but is everyone once again just playing for second behind the Patriots, or dare we say Miami has gotten better with Sue? The Jets got Revis off the Patriots. He's back in New York. Buffalo, we're talking about improving from 9-7. Is there a chance that a team other than the defending Super Bowl champion New England Patriots could actually win the AFC East?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wouldn't put any of those other teams above the Patriots right now, but there's no question every team in that conference got or division got a lot better. A move from Miami I really liked on top of Sue is they traded or they signed Jordan Cameron from the Browns, the tight end, and that fills a huge need there. I mean, he's an elite tight end. So I think a lot of talent there. Buffalo's gotten better. I mean, the quarterback situation is going to really make or break their season, but certainly they're going to be a lot more fun to watch, a lot more dynamic. I still got to think that the Patriots are at the top of that list, but I mean, it's never been more in contention than right now.
It's amazing what a couple of months, what a difference it can make for a franchise, because it was not that long ago we were talking about the Buffalo Bills, maybe when Ralph Wilson died, being sold to Rodgers and, you know, maybe a bunch of different people and moving to Toronto and them being a sad sack franchise. Remember, going into this year, they were expected to be one of the worst teams in the NFL. That yeah. opening game against the Chicago Bears, a lot of people took the Bears in their eliminator pools. And they beat the Bears. And we learned a lot in that game. Part of it was, yeah, the Bills are good. Part of it was the Bears stunk this year. But now they have a new owner. The Bagulas are keeping that team in Buffalo, clearly. And they make this huge splash in the offseason, first with the head coach and now with the free agent signings and the trade.
Huge trade.
You still have to live in Buffalo, but at least you got something to talk about when it comes to the football side of things.
Yeah, and I mean, the LeSean McCoy trade was really interesting. And like you said, I mean, DeMarco Murray got more touches than I can remember in recent history. But McCoy's already said, you know, I'm guaranteed 25 touches a game next year, which, I mean, I think I'd be blown away if that actually happens. But you're going to see a lot from him, which is going to be exciting for the fans because he's still fun to watch. I mean, you have to wonder, that trade was pretty puzzling because Kiki Alonso is a guy who I think everyone expects big things out of. Young guy only getting better. And the question with the running back's window being so small is, you know, how much does McCoy have left? So there's no guarantees with what's going on in Buffalo, but ultimately, I mean, you got to love what they did.
The Philadelphia Eagles, though, as you expanded to a larger conversation, are the talk of the NFL offseason with what they've done. And part of it, yeah, was that LeSean McCoy trade that sent him from Philly to the Buffalo Bills. They add DeMarco Murray. They add Ryan Matthews. They add Sam Bradford. Out the door goes Nick Foles, Jeremy Maclin. Incredible that not a single player remains on that team from the Andy Reid era. They've completely revamped a roster for a team that was pretty good offensively and did finish with 10 wins last season to completely tear it up the way they've done this season. Chip Kelly's gotten a lot of heat, but is it too early to tell how that's going to work out, Ryan?
I think so, especially with a team that is so distinct because of the Chip Kelly factor. You know, it's funny, like Chip Kelly is kind of making moves like he's Bill Belichick, but he doesn't have the credibility, right? Like, these are the kind of moves that we're used to seeing out of New England going, well, I don't understand it, but it must make sense because Bill Belichick's doing it, except we're doing it with a guy who's been in the league for only 2 years. So, yeah, I mean, no one really fully knows how to, you know, how to make sense of all this. But at the same time, I mean, I guess you do see some potential there. I mean, the Bradford thing is interesting because he's obviously been banged up. And now I believe entering the last year of his contract, you know, even if he goes out there and has a great year, it's like, all right, well, now are you ready to commit to him? He's been hurt so much. Who knows? Mm-hmm. So, it's a fascinating, fascinating situation.
And I don't ultimately understand the kind of negativity around it, because I understand they're getting rid of a lot of names, and maybe that's why Chip Kelly is drawing the ire of a lot of fans.
People hate change. Yeah. I think that's what it is.
Maybe, but like, they're certainly going to be different, but I don't know if they're going to be any worse. I mean, you look at the talent they brought on board, it's pretty impressive.
And Philly is symbolic of the larger theme in the NFL, which we sometimes aren't as accustomed to following the other sports, where it's you will absolutely cut free the guy who was the best player on your team 14 months ago, you know, like sweeping change like this in the NFL just isn't, we're not conditioned to it when, you know, the Pittsburgh Penguins just don't go, all right, you know what, Malkin's out of here. Yeah. We're going to try another awesome center. You know, it just doesn't work like that. So it still kind of blows our mind when a team's like, all right, a year after getting rid of DeSean Jackson, our best receiver, we're going to get rid of LeSean McCoy and a guy who just threw pass after pass for us 2 years ago. But it's, you know, sure, it's concentrated right now in Philly, but moves like this it happens in the NFL.
Well, yeah, part of it is that careers are so short.
Sure.
Also, head coaches, GMs, their careers are so short too. Mm-hmm. So we talk about, you know, Chip Kelly maybe not having the cachet of a Bill Belichick. You almost have to take these risks and moves now, because if you don't do what you truly believe and you kind of play it up for you know, appearances sake, and the results aren't there, you're going to be out the door anyways.
Sure.
So you might as well put your players on the field. And yep. It seems that's what Chip Kelly has done in Philadelphia. And it would have been interesting to see what they had done with Marcus Mariota. But according to Kelly, that's not happening. Who knows if that's just a ploy to devalue the pick. But it would have been interesting to see what Marcus Mariota did with his old head coach there in Oregon.
Hey, what do we think of what New Orleans is doing? Because I think it's, I don't know if sad is the word, but I mean, it certainly seems like they're kind of writing off this chapter of Saints football.
Well, I think obviously they had such a rough year last year.
Yeah.
Again, they might to some degree believe they're getting ahead of things, getting ahead of the end of the Drew Brees era, which has been a lot of fun in New Orleans. So who knows? And you know, because of all this player change, fortunes rise and fall so quickly in the NFL that New Orleans may be scaling back for a year, or may be bad again for a year, but believes that, you know, in 2016, it can be right back contending. So, but you're right. I think New Orleans was sort of like the Chicago Blackhawks before they won their Stanley Cup. They're like everyone's second favorite team,
yeah,
right? So
everyone
pays attention a little bit.
Yeah. The deal you're talking about, Jimmy Graham heading to Seattle, for Max Unger and a first-round pick. So the Seahawks pick up, outside of Rob Gronkowski, and everybody's second and a distant second to Gronk. But if you're talking about that second tier, it seems Jimmy Graham is clearly the elite of that second
tier. I love that move for Seattle. I love the fact that they were, you know, a play away from winning the Super Bowl, and they're still not scared to go out and make a huge splash to get that much better. And you think of, like, that final drive in the Super Bowl, how much difference a target like Jimmy Graham would have made there. I really like what they did. And I mean, the passing game was their biggest hole, right? That was the thing they obviously need to get better. But we're saying they hadn't drafted any of the receivers in that Super Bowl game. They're relying on, what was his name, Chris Matthews?
Yeah, relying on people who are, you know, bagging groceries at Safeway.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost. Selling shoes at Foot Locker.
There you go. And now they have a you know, proper number one target. I love it.
Although we shouldn't rip guys that bag groceries at Safeway. You used to bag groceries at Loblaws. Sorry, I know you push carts.
Long goes. Yeah, I never bagged the groceries. Never made it that far. Can only dream.
That was, you aspired to that. Also, the Indy Colts, they grab Frank Gore, Andre Johnson. That's an interesting one, because Johnson, I mean, it wasn't that long ago. You talk about how short lifespans and career spans are in the NFL. It wasn't that long ago Andre Johnson was the elite of the elite.
And I still think he's got a ton left in him.
Well, what do you make of that deal? Because the Colts are, you know, they're revamping their rebuild. Mm-hmm. Has been accelerated by drafting the quarterback, which is, I mean, remember when that was a debate, Andrew Luck or Robert Griffin III? In hindsight, clearly shouldn't have been a discussion.
Yeah.
But they're further along and still not quite in that elite class. Got completely outplayed by the Patriots in the playoffs, mm-hmm. but making an addition of a veteran like Gore and Johnson maybe puts them over the top.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so sold on Gore. I think he's in decline. Again, we were talking about it before, running backs is such a small window. But the Andre Johnson one, you know, I think they're another team where you looked at them, and outside of T.Y. Hilton, it was a huge drop-off in the receiving core there. So now you bring in a Pro Bowl kind of caliber receiver like Andre Johnson, and it's a huge symbol that, you know, they really want to compete. Their success over the last year or two wasn't a fluke. Like you said, they have the quarterback there, which is the most important piece in the NFL right now. So to bring them a weapon like that, I think it's only a positive move for them. Sucks for the Texans.
Yeah, it's been an exciting offseason already. It's going to get even more exciting, I think, at the draft, because this is one of the more interesting drafts in recent memory when you got those two quarterbacks in Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota. All right, that'll do it for another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. Coming up, I've got a little mini edition of Sportsnet today. We'll talk a little Blue Jays. We get you set for the Blue Jays and Yankees from Dunedin. For Dave Zarum and Ryan Dixon, I'm Ben Ennis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.